It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says we have a skewed picture of farming in the United States thanks to a flaw in the way federal data is collected.
First, President-elect Donald Trump announced earlier this morning on Twitter that he is formally nominating Rex Tillerson to the position of Secretary of State.
The ExxonMobil chairman and CEO is rumored to be in the running for the top diplomatic job this week, even after Trump had met with high-profile contenders like Mitt Romney.
Well, Tillerson has gotten some high-profile support. There have been concerns about his lack of government experience and his ties to Russia. David Graham joins us now. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where he specializes in U.S. politics and global news. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, in general terms, David, what do we know about Rex Tillerson?
We know that he is sort of Mr. Exxon. His entire career has been inside Exxon, working his way up through the ranks, up to CEO. And so we know a fair amount about his business career, and we know very little about what sort of foreign policy he might oversee.
Now, until this announcement, Donald Trump was reported to be considering other picks, including Rudy Giuliani and even Mitt Romney. So what do we know about why Trump moved away from those choices to Tillerson?
We don't know a great deal. Tillerson fits with some of the nominees who he's picked. He's a business leader. He has a sort of friendly attitude toward Russia. So those match with some of the other picks. It's a little bit hard to know. Rudy Giuliani says he removed himself from the running. David Petraeus was another candidate who is speaking to Trump. And while some of these picks have produced a fair amount of kind of noise on the leak side about what exactly was going on, it's a little bit harder to tell with Tillerson. He says that he's a respected businessman and he likes his foreign experience, but that's most of what we know at this point.
So he has foreign experience from his longtime career at ExxonMobil. What do we know about any background he might have in diplomacy?
As far as we know, it is basically his business experience. And some of that has been, he worked in Russia at length. He worked in Yemen. He's worked around the globe. A company as large as Exxon in some ways acts like a sort of state. It has to have its own foreign policy. It has to negotiate foreign alliances. It has to deal with things like sanctions. So he's been a big critic of U.S. sanctions on Russia, which were bad for Exxon's business. So that seems to be his experience.
Now, his relationship with Russia has been raised as a point of concern, and Tillerson has publicly questioned U.S. sanctions on Russia in the past. How would you describe his relationship with Vladimir Putin and with Russia in general?
It seems very close, and I think it's a thing that's born out of business exigency. So when he says he opposes sanctions, he said it's because he thinks that it hurts Exxon's ability. His friendship with Putin seems to basically, reflect, again, the oil business. So Exxon had a major partnership with Rosneft, which is the Russian state oil company, in terms of production. And he was awarded a few years ago the Order of Friendship, which is an award that the Russian president gives out. He has these sort of business ties through those channels.
Now, in the last few days, the CIA has said that Russia hacked or meddled in the U.S. elections in favor of Donald Trump. How does the Tillerson pick look against the backdrop of that particular story?
It's very interesting. Over the last few days, you saw some of the more hawkish members of the Republican Senate caucus speaking out critically both about the hacking matter and about Tillerson. So, you had folks like John McCain and Lindsey Graham saying that they were concerned about hacking and Russia interfering with elections, and that it was something the Senate needed to investigate. And yesterday, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, said they would do that. At the same time, you had some of the same senators saying they were uncomfortable with Tillerson, or they had questions about Tillerson because of his close relationship with Putin and with the Russian government. So, in some ways, it seems like Trump is kind of pushing his edge. He thinks that he can win on the Russia issue. He doesn't seem to take the Republican opposition about hacking very seriously. And so he's happy to go ahead with a pick who many of them have criticized or said that they have some serious questions about.
Right. You mentioned those senators who said they've had concerns, among them John McCain and Marco Rubio. Rubio tweeting some concerns. Is there enough there to potentially block a confirmation in the Senate?
Well, you know, it's a close Senate. Democrats are down, but they're not down by very much. So it wouldn't take a great deal of a defection. If every Democrat voted against Tillerson and a few Republicans peeled off, that could be a problem. And the way, you know, there hasn't been a blocked cabinet appointee since 1989. But we have seen appointees or nominees who have withdrawn because they sort of see the wind shifting. And, you know, the Senate's sort of a weird body that works in its own ways. And so if there's a shift in mood pretty quickly, and a nominee can be in trouble and have to withdraw or be defeated.
David Graham is with us right now. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where he covers U.S. politics and global news. And we're talking about President-elect Donald Trump's nomination of ExxonMobil chairman and CEO Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. And Tillerson does come with the recommendation of three former cabinet secretaries, including Condoleezza Rice and James Baker. What do you make of their support, and what have they said?
So it's fairly interesting because these are folks who have a lot of currency across the Republican Party. You know, they are old school Republicans, you know, who don't have a reputation for being soft on Russia and their policies. Condoleezza Rice, in fact, was a Sovietologist in academia before she went into government. And so, you know, they maybe have very genuine beliefs that Tillerson is a great fit for this job. They also have some business ties to Tillerson, which might help color their impression. Condi Rice and Robert Gates work for a consulting business that's worked with Exxon. James Baker's law firm, Baker Botts, represents Exxon and also Rosneft. So, you know, you see these places where they have some ties, some business ties as well. So even as we're talking about how Tillerson's ties to Russia through Exxon might affect the way he conducts foreign policy, these former cabinet secretaries' views on foreign policy may be informed by the business ties they also have.
Now, as we've talked about other potential cabinet appointments in the Trump administration, the word controversial has come up for several of them. Is this considered a controversial appointment, or is this one that is maybe not as difficult for some people to swallow, including Democrats?
I think it's controversial in different ways. You can look at somebody like Ben Carson, who had a somewhat divisive presidential campaign, has said that he doesn't think he's qualified to run a federal agency, and who has no experience in housing and urban development, which is the agency he has been nominated to run. You can look at somebody like Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator nominee, who has a very adversarial attitude and basically thinks that a lot of environmental regulation is bad. So those are controversial in one way. Tillerson is different. I mean, even Tillerson's critics think of him as a very competent administrator and businessman. The question is whether his ties to Russia and his lack of experience in diplomacy ought to rule him out. And what's interesting is for all of the controversy that you get, particularly on the left, about people like Pruitt and about Carson, Tillerson is the first one that seems to have really raised some red flags for Republicans in the Senate, who are the people who will make the decision about whether he gets confirmed.
What sorts of signals might we see in the coming days and weeks that Senate Republicans will be receptive to this pick, or maybe that the opposition will pick up?
Yeah, that's a good question. If you look at the statements from people like Rubio and McCain, you know, they are careful to leave the door open. They say that they're very concerned. They have a lot of questions they would like to ask Tillerson. But they don't say they would not support him unequivocally. So he'll be making the rounds. You know, he'll be meeting with senators. He'll be talking to the press. He'll be talking to about what his views are. And so that'll be a chance for him to signal where his views are on Russia and what his foreign policy might be like. And then we'll start to see those senators and other senators coming out with their decisions about, you know, whether they can go forward. I think a lot of it depends what they hear from him, both one-to-one and in hearings and his public statements.
And for some senators, will he need to unequivocally condemn Vladimir Putin?
I think he will have to condemn him in some way, which is a difficult needle to thread. If he's being picked because he has a good relationship with the Kremlin, he has to be careful about how he goes about that. And it looks as though that might be an important reason for his selection. On the other hand, he does have to convince enough of these senators that he's not going to be a sort of pushover. He's not going to do the bidding of the Kremlin. And so he'll have to thread that needle, which I guess will be a good demonstration of whether or not he has the diplomatic chops it takes to be the nation's top diplomat.
David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was David Graham, staff writer for The Atlantic, where he covers U.S. politics and global news. He was with us there to talk about President-elect Trump's nomination of ExxonMobil chairman and CEO Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll take a look at the best books of 2016 with the editorial director of books for The New York Times.
Right now, there have been a lot of changes in farming in recent decades and major changes in the size of farm operations. According to U.S. data, there's been an increase in the very largest scale farms and a drop in mid-sized operations. But contrary to predictions, really small farms seem to be sticking around in high numbers.
Our next guest says that's not quite right, though, because the data counts a lot of properties as farms that aren't really farms the way most of us would think of them. And she says that may skew federal funding priorities.
Maggie Kurth-Baker joins us. She's a senior science writer for 538.com. Maggie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, on the surface, before we correct some of this data, what does it look like has happened with farms over the last couple of decades?
Well, there's definitely been consolidation of farms. So one of the major trends that has happened is that you kind of have this squeezing in the middle where you've gotten a lot more big farms as farms kind of have smushed together into larger entities. And you've ended up with a lot of smaller farms, but the kind of mid-sized farms, particularly of the sort that I think like a lot of people who aren't familiar with farming imagine when they think of farming, those have shrunk. The number of those have shrunk.
But there were predictions that the overall number of farms would decline, and based on the data as it's currently collected, that doesn't seem to have happened.
Right, yeah. So I was looking at I was reading a book, actually, by Osha Gray Davidson called Broken Heartland that was written in the 1980s. And in that book, he had what was then contemporary prediction that the number of farms was going to drop by half by the year 2000. And I got curious about whether that had actually happened. And when I went and looked, it hadn't. The number of farms has stayed fairly stable since about 1989. And I started trying to kind of dig into that to sort of understand, at first wondering why the research had made a wrong prediction, and then later kind of trying to understand how their prediction that the number of farms was going to decrease or that farms were going to consolidate had turned out to be correct, but that the overall number of farms hadn't actually fallen, even though the consolidation they predicted had happened.
And that's where you started to get into almost a metaphysical question in a way. What is a farm? And some of these farms at the smaller end are maybe not what a lot of people would think of as a farm. Can you talk about what is going on there and how we measure it that may have thrown this off?
Right. So, you know, you don't really think about it much, but when you are doing a count of farms, you're doing a census, you have to have like some sort of definition of what constitutes a farm. Part of the definition that we use for the Census of Agriculture measures the value of what is on that property. So that can be like livestock, or it could be farm equipment, or it could be produce that could be sold. And it's measured as $1,000 worth of value, not in terms of $1,000 in sales, but $1,000 of something that could be sold. And $1,000 isn't very much. That was a level that was set in the 1970s, and it hasn't been adjusted for inflation. And because it doesn't have to do with actual sales, that means that you can have, you know, somebody can own a few horses, or they could own a tractor, and all of a sudden you count as a farm, even if you're not actually working as a farm. So that ends up incorporating a lot of things that I think most people would really more likely identify as, you know, kind of hobby farms or as large suburban plots that happen to have a horse on them.
Right. Or if I went out and decided, hey, I'm going to buy land, I'm going to plow up half an acre of it. If I were a better gardener, I could probably come up with $1,000 worth of hypothetical stuff there, and I would count as a farmer all of a sudden.
Right, yeah, because it's not a very high bar to clear.
Do we have a sense of how many of these things that, as you say, might be hobby farms or large lots with a couple horses, how many of those there are that are throwing off what we think of as our number of farms in this country?
So this is something that experts told me is actually one of the problems, that we don't know in real detail how many of those small farms are actual farms, how many of those small farms are, you know, somebody's hobby farm that is maybe selling some stuff but not much, and how many of those things are, you know, effectively the yards of the upper middle class.
We're talking to Maggie Kurth Baker about a piece she wrote on farms in the United States. Looks like the number of farms isn't going down, but only because the numbers might be a bit skewed. A lot of things that aren't really farms are being counted as farms. Maggie, it seems like an easy solution, and you write about this, would be to say, hey, let's take that $1,000 threshold and bump it up, maybe $5,000. That's a place where we could call something a farm. Why hasn't this easy solution been implemented?
Nobody knows exactly why the easy solution hasn't been implemented. You know, I couldn't get a really solid answer on that. It's something that has been studied by people within the USDA, particularly the Economic Research Service Department has published papers on that. And a lot of it comes down, though, to the fact that however you change that definition, there's no perfect definition. You know, however you do it, some things are going to get left out that shouldn't be. Some things are going to be included that shouldn't be. And the result is likely to be people that are unhappy. And those people that are unhappy have congressmen. And those congressmen do not necessarily have an incentive to approve a new definition, while they have an incentive to just not do anything. The definition has to be approved by Congress.
So why does it matter if we don't have accurate statistics on the number of farms? What do we lose if we don't have, if not a perfect measurement, a better measurement than we're currently using?
Well, it affects some of the way that certain kinds of money to agriculture is distributed. So some of the research dollars for land-grant universities and certain kinds of farm benefit programs are distributed based on the number of farms in that state or in that district. And in that case, you might have some places that don't actually have as many farms as they seem to, getting large amounts of money because they're being counted as having more farms. You know, there's one district in Texas that I looked at that the number of farms in that district would be cut by something like half if you change the definition.
There's a lot of gray area, it sounds like, at the low end of the spectrum. These smaller farms, are they farms, are they not? One trend that appears to be pretty solid that you write about is there's a perception that we're seeing more big consolidated farms. The numbers really do seem to bear that out, don't they?
Yeah, we are seeing a lot more larger farms. The one thing that turned out to be really interesting about that is that the vast majority of those, like higher than 95% of those, are still family farms. They're farms that are owned by and operated by people within a single family. They might be incorporated for tax purposes. You know, when I was a freelancer for 10 years, I was incorporated for tax purposes, but that didn't make me Monsanto, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting twist on, I think, what a lot of us, the perception that I think a lot of us have is that when you have one of these farms, it's like 1,000 acres or 2,000 acres, that that's likely to be something owned by a corporation, but that's not necessarily true.
Right, yeah, there's the perception, or there are these small to mid-sized family farms out there, and then there are these big CAFOs for livestock, or big multi-field, what used to be a whole bunch of different farms merged together, and that's often referred to as corporate agriculture. That could still be incorporated, though, but a family, it's pretty common, you say.
Yeah, it's extremely common. And there's a lot of gray area with this, though, too. I mean, I think that one of the takeaways is that that there are certain farming practices that people, there are reasonable reasons to question, but that those farming practices often get talked about as corporate farming, and maybe that's not the right language to talk about them because they're being used by large farmers who are families as well as by corporations. And the way that farming works in the U.S., large farmers are more likely to be a family operation, you know, even if they are hiring people to work under them even if they are an extended family, that's still a family. And, you know, the language that you use to talk about the problems matters.
Right. You know, looking at the census, the farm census numbers, as you have, kind of shakes up some assumptions that I and probably a lot of people have. What kind of maybe reporting would you like to see either you or some other people do that might help flesh out our picture of what is actually happening on farms in this country?
You know, I did not grow up on a farm, but my mom's family all farmed. And I think that, and still do farm, though I think they are sort of following the trends that a lot of farmers do, in that nobody in my family now farms exclusively. They have other jobs and kind of farm on the side. And partly that is an economic issue, and partly it is an issue of technology. You know, it's a lot easier now because of bigger tractors, because of tools that have come along, to work one job in construction and farm some land on the side. You no longer need to spend all your time doing the farming. But I think that there's a lot of that kind of nuance that doesn't really get into the media, in large part because a lot of the biggest voices in the media are coming from farm country. So I think that there are some interesting stories about what farming actually looks like that still need to be told. And I think that there are also some interesting stories that could be told about how farmers make environmental and economic decisions when they work. You know, I've had some interesting conversations with my uncle about the fact that, you know, he's somebody who loves fishing, he's somebody who loves the outdoors, and he is concerned about what we know about how pesticide runoff affects downstream waters. But he also is concerned about making sure that he can produce the quantity of corn that he has been producing, and making sure that he can, you know, meet his own economic goals, and that that requires pesticide use. So there are complicated decisions that people are making, and it's not, you know, it's not necessarily evil big ag versus us. It's individuals who have very difficult decisions to make and don't necessarily know the right decision to make in those circumstances.
We'll leave it there. Maggie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Maggie Kurth-Baker. Her piece on farming is linked at the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to a health reporter about the group insurance board meeting today, where a decision on self-insurance for state workers was postponed for the time being.
First, we want to know, what's the best book you read in 2016, whether it was new or just new to you? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What book do you wish you'd read this year? What new book maybe grabbed your interest?
Radhika Jones is with us now to talk about her picks for the best books of 2016. She's the editorial director of books for the New York Times. She joins us from a studio at the New York Times. Radhika, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, would you say that 2016 was a good year for books?
I would say it was a great year for books. I personally found that it was a great year for books that felt very timely. So you could be paying a lot of attention to the news and the stories that were sort of coming up out of actual human experience, and find a lot of those same themes and fears and anxieties reflected in not just the nonfiction of the year, but also the fiction.
And when it comes to a great year for books, for timely books, you're saying, how do you narrow it down to 10 books, 5 fiction and 5 nonfiction?
Well, I should say that the New York Times best books list, even though a lot of these books happen to be very timely, is less about their newsiness than it is about the sheer quality of the books that we're looking at. This is a list that generates a lot of discussion and debate here at the Times in the book section. We look at all of the books that we've reviewed over the year and talk about the author's ambition, about the quality of the reporting in the case of nonfiction, the literary execution in the case of fiction and nonfiction, the sheer power of the storytelling. And so we really do feel that these are the best books of 2016.
Yeah, how heated does that discussion get? There were a lot of heavy hitters that didn't make your top 10 list, including Ann Patchett, Walter Mosley, Annie Proulx. So how into this do you get when you discuss it?
Well, you know, book people are very passionate people. They have strong opinions, and that's great. Look, I feel like all lists are invitations to debate and discuss. So, you know, it's really a great problem to have, to feel that there are a wealth of books from which to choose. But the titles that ended up on our 10 best list, I think are, I know speaking personally, these are books that I feel very good about pushing on all of my family and friends. So heads up, this is what you're all getting for Christmas.
Talking to Radhika Jones from the New York Times, looking at the 10 best books as reported by the Times of 2016. Let's start getting into some of the, let's start on the fiction side. The Association of Small Bombs. I understand this follows the lives of people affected by a Kashmiri terrorist attack in a Delhi market. So talk about that book. What put that on the list?
This is just an incredibly dramatic and propulsive book. And I think the thing that made it stand out for me when I read it is that it's a book that kind of feels, the event that precipitates it feels a little bit ripped from the headlines. It's a sort of what we would call a small terrorist attack, small scale, about two dozen people killed. But the story follows the lives of the people who were affected by this bomb. And as you can imagine, a lost life is a lost life. It doesn't matter if there were 20 or 2,000. And so in this particular attack, two young boys are killed, and we follow the afterlife of their parents and their friend who was on the scene but was not killed, but also notably the people who set the bomb, the terrorists, and we learn about them, their backstories, what happens to them in the future. And it, you know, it forces your imagination maybe into places that you might not want it to go, but that's what makes it ambitious and ultimately extremely powerful.
That's interesting, because as you say, it's ripped from the headlines in many ways, and sadly we see this headline all the time, bombing in market in insert place here. It sounds like it tries to add some humanity behind that story we'd read, feel bad about for a few seconds, and then forget about.
Yeah, I mean, when news events like that become repetitive, you know, it can be difficult even for the most well-meaning, informed citizen of the world to follow that narrative, you know, for even months, let alone years or decades. And so this book kind of shows us what that would be like to be able to follow the aftermath of a devastating event.
Moving on to another book, Colson Whitehead has been around for a long time, turning out great books, and he's got another excellent book on your list. The Underground Railroad is on the list, and it centers on a slave fleeing north on a literal Underground Railroad. That's a part of the novelty of this book. What stood out to you about this one?
Well, it's true, as you say, Colson Whitehead has been an acclaimed novelist for some time now, but this book was very special, even within his own canon. It just had this incredible... He's someone who really writes compellingly about technology and humanity, and sometimes that takes interesting turns. He's written a zombie novel, for example. In this case, he took the metaphor of the Underground Railroad and made it real, made it literal. It's something that you can imagine. I mean, he talked about this when he talked about the book, that many children mistakenly believe that it was a real railroad, that it could transport slaves to freedom. And what was fascinating to me was that not only did he take that step of making it literal and making you understand the territory that would have to be covered for a slave to escape from the Deep South, but he also made it a bit of a time-traveling device. So his protagonist, Cora, an escaped slave, she emerges from the railroad in various states, but also into various periods of history in the United States. And so it ends up being not just a novel about slavery, as if that wouldn't be enough, but also a novel that encompasses a lot of the African-American experience. And this is something, you know, that I think just has animated a lot of conversation over the last few years in American culture and in American life. So it's an incredibly valuable story, extremely compelling.
Let's move on to another one now. These first two we've talked about, I'm sold. I want to read these. This next one you're going to have to sell me on a little more, though, I think. The North Water, author named Ian McGuire. I understand it's an opium-addicted Irish surgeon, 19th century, ends up on a ship with a psychopath of some sort, really brutally violent, as I understand. I'm not thinking this is something I want to read. What is it that makes that story click?
Are you not a whaling fan?
Well,
you're not into whaling
stories? No, Moby Dick may have. I may have read Moby Dick at the wrong time and it turned me off to it. I don't know.
Well, the way that we describe it, it's a picture of a meeting between Joseph Conrad and Cormac McCarthy. Yes, there's some.
Again, still not. Sorry.
Well, not all books are for everybody, but.
Well, that's a very good point. Thank you for jumping in.
Sure. What did you like about it?
It's there's something to be said for grimness and bleakness in storytelling. I think for us it really was about the vision that this writer had that was just incredibly steeped in this strange history of this profession and that kind of isolation that it would engender. When you are really with other men, barely more than beasts themselves, out in the elements, doing something that is incredibly elemental in the most real sense of the word. So, again, I think as with Joseph Conrad, as with Cormac McCarthy, maybe not for everyone, but in a funny way, kind of both very modern and also a little bit of a throwback, and I think that appeals to people.
Is this one of those books that's kind of especially effective if you read it in winter where everything is dark and cold and stark and you've got a little bit of ennui going on and you want to lean into that emotion?
I think it's worth trying for sure. Yes. Cuddle up. You can be somewhere warm and comfortable, unlike the people in this book. So that might bring you a little pleasure.
Well, we're talking right now with Radhika Jones from the New York Times. She's sharing her favorite books of 2016 and the papers. They had a big discussion, decided what was going to be on this 10 best list, and we're hearing about it.
You can see that 10 top picks list linked at the Central Time Facebook page. You can join in with your favorite books of the year or that were new to you this year at 800-642-1234. Do you want to make the case for something as a best book of 2016? What's your favorite one that you read this year? Again, new or new to you? And what are you recommending to others? What are you maybe giving to other people for Christmas through the holiday season or loaning to people, hoping to get back someday? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post your suggestions and check out this list on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion right now about the best books of 2016 with Radhika Jones, editorial director of books for the New York Times.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What books would you like to give or receive as a gift this year? What books struck you in 2016 as a cut above? What were some of your favorites? Do you need a recommendation, maybe? Call in at 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page, find a link to the New York Times list of 5 fiction, 5 nonfiction books.
And Radhika, what would your recommendation be from this list if you've got someone you're shopping for this holiday season who loves novels and they're looking for something that's maybe original that they haven't really seen before?
Well, if you're person doesn't mind taking a little bit of a risk, I would say The Vegetarian, which is a novel by a Korean writer translated into English this year. And it's a very simple story on the face of it. A housewife in Korea wakes up one morning. She's had a very vivid dream, and she has decided, because of this dream, to stop eating meat. So, okay, lots of us make dietary choices in our lives, and some of them are whimsical, and some of them are rooted in something more thoughtful. But what's fascinating about this book is that it becomes this kind of psychological spiral. Her decision changes her relationship with her spouse, with her parents, with her siblings. It changes her relationship to her body and ultimately to the outside world. And it's just this kind of mesmerizing interior look at a person whose single-mindedness becomes her undoing. In New York, if you're a reader, you have a benchmark. If the book makes you miss your subway stop, it's worth passing along. And I missed a couple of stops reading this book. So it's extremely engrossing and different, just very original and different. And one nice thing is that because this book was received well in the States, more of her work will be coming out in English in the near future. So there will be more to come.
It's a subway moment, kind of like those public radio driveway moments we talk about.
That's right.
We'll bring out a caller now. We've got Janet with us in Burlington. Janet, hi.
Hi. So I read three books by a gentleman by the name of Kent Nerburn, N-E-R-B-U-R-N. And all of the books were about his true experiences with an elderly Native American gentleman. And in light of what's been going on out in the Dakotas recently, these books are absolutely fascinating, and he hasn't written enough of them. I highly recommend them.
Janet, thanks for the recommendation. Kent Nerburn. And let's go, Radhika, to some of the nonfiction picks now. We probably won't get to all of them. One close to home made the list. Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. This follows Milwaukee and people living and facing the risk of eviction there. What made that make the top of the list here?
This is just a terrific book about something that we probably don't a topic we don't know well enough. We don't hear enough of these stories. Matthew Desmond was a sociology student, a graduate student, in 2008, and he took notes on the lives of people who were on the brink of eviction. And the book that results is just incredibly empathetic. It is exhaustively researched and reported, and it brings you into the lives of people whose stories we might just not want to see or not be able to see. So it's incredibly valuable as a piece of reporting about America, and particularly about America in an age of economic anxiety.
Let's take another caller now. We've got John on the line in Middleton. John, hi.
Hi. I read an obscure business novel called The Non-Product Consolidation Operation. It's the funniest business humor book I've ever seen in my life. It's very short, takes about 4 hours to read, and I guarantee if you read it, you'll laugh out loud.
So this is a genre, business humor. I don't know if I've zeroed in on that as a genre before, business humor. So this is the non-product consolidation operation. Is this a genre that you're aware of? Radhika?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
I was learning along with you. No, although a book that you can read in 4 hours and that will make you laugh a lot, I'm game.
Sounds good. And are there any funny ones that didn't make the list, as long as we're talking about humor books?
Oh, wow. Probably too many to count. There must be a joke in there. I'll think of it after we're done, I'm sure.
Well, Radhika, that does make me think. This is a fairly heavy list, reading-wise. What do you read for fun, maybe for a break between some of the heavier fare?
Oh, let's see. What do I read for fun? I'll tell you something I read this year. I don't know if you'd call it fun exactly, but it was very soothing. Bear with me. It's not about whaling. It started out not fun because we were hearing so much about the Zika virus. I went back and read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which was, of course, about DDT and the mosquito. I was so enamored of that book, even though it's such a tough topic, that I went back and read. She wrote this beautiful trilogy about the sea, so I read her three books about the sea, and one of them is really all about the tidal line. So it's about all the creatures that live in this zone that's sort of half water, half sand. And I'll tell you, it was just incredibly restful to leave the 24/7 news cycle at the end of the day and spend time through Rachel Carson, this amazing environmental writer, just kind of slowly studying tidal pools along with her. So I recommend some nature writing for anyone who wants to get away from it all.
Mm, that does sound good. Another book taking us back into the heavier territory again, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. It's a book by Jane Mayer, and we did interview her on this program. I remember this interview, and she's writing about the Koch brothers. It took her years to research. What hit home about the writing of this one?
This is a subject that fans of Jane Mayer have obviously been following her on for years. And I think, you know, the savvier the American public gets about elections and the way that they are run, the more transparent those operations become, the more interested people are in, you know, who is funding campaigns, whose agenda is rising to the top and why, who are the people who are writing checks to support certain policy initiatives or agendas. And, you know, she's just the complete master of pulling all of that reporting together and showing you a picture of the foundation, you know, the sort of source of a lot of the issues that we're all wrestling with today. So I think she's absolutely the expert at this point on the Koch brothers and how they have used their fortune to determine a lot of the American political agenda. So to be an informed citizen these days, I think, is to encounter the work of Jane Mayer.
It's Dark Money by Jane Mayer. We're talking to Radhika Jones from the New York Times, looking at the Times' best 10 books of 2016. We'll get to a couple more of them, I think. Staying in nonfiction, now this one's in philosophy. Sarah Bakewell's At the Existentialist Cafe, Freedom, Being, and Apricot Cocktails, the story of some 20th century, mostly, I think, philosophers.
Yes, although I was in it for the cocktails.
Yeah, tell us about that one.
it's one of those sort of terrific moments where you have a group of intellectuals who come together and their whole becomes more than the sum of its parts. But what's striking about Sarah Bakewell's book is that she really is able to engage with a lot of complex philosophy, while at the same time drawing out what's really fascinating and engaging about these characters who did have very outsized lives. So it's sort of fun to be with her learning about the ways that they thought and how their legacy affects us today.
And you've got one here for people who love memoirs. I'm one of these people. I love memoirs. And it's interesting, this memoir written by Susan Faludi, who we think of as doing sort of feminist journalism. This is a memoir called In the Dark Room. What's that about?
It is so interesting with a writer like Susan Faludi, who we know so well in a certain context. And then she came out with this memoir that really showed a whole other side to her life. She learned that her estranged father had undergone gender reassignment surgery, and he wanted to have a new relationship with her. He wanted to be back in touch with her. He was a man who was full of contradictions, a very, very difficult character, to say the least, and she, you know, really tries to meet her halfway. You know, it's hard to imagine in any circumstances, coming to relearn a parent when that parent fundamentally changes. And for someone like Susan Faludi, who has been in certain ways immersed in gender issues her entire life, you can imagine the depth of thought and emotion that she brings to this topic when it involves her own father.
And as you say, this is something not what we would expect from Susan Faludi. She is a good storyteller.
Yeah, and it's just a terrific story. It's a very unique story, and her perspective is very unique.
Well, Radhika, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope everyone has a great reading holiday.
That was Radhika Jones, Editorial Director of Books for The New York Times, and you can check out her list of the best books of 2016 over on the Central Time Facebook page, and hopefully add your own nominations. You've probably been reading during 2016. Tell us what you think. What would be on your top 10 list of 2016?
Yeah, definitely interested in seeing what people think. I think from this list, it's a toss-up for me in the fiction Underground Railroad, Association of Small Bombs looks good. The Vegetarian. I don't know. What would you reach for first?
I'm not sure. I think that the Susan Faludi sounds okay. Pretty intriguing. I also read another great one called The Nest this year, which was fun. It's nice, kind of escapist fiction.
Again, share your favorites on the Central Time Facebook page. With the holiday season coming up, a lot of people are looking ahead to holiday food and looking up recipes online.
But what foods are we looking up, and what's the top food search in each state? The General Mills Company looked at the searches on their various websites and let us know the top searches for every state.
No surprise, a lot of states went with some form of cookie. There are Christmas cookies in Minnesota, sugar cookies in Michigan and Washington, peanut butter cookies in three different states.
And some states went with the regional specialties, chowder in Maine, crab cakes in Maryland, and Buckeyes, those little peanut butter things in Ohio.
Oh, I love those Buckeyes, even though I'm from Michigan. So what won here in Wisconsin? The number one holiday search food is...
drumroll.
Taco dip.
Taco dip.
The traditional Wisconsin taco dip. I have a theory.
Well, what's your theory?
So, yes, you might serve taco dip at a holiday get-together, no problem. But these holiday searches are also happening during football season.
Yeah, that was my guess, too.
Yeah, maybe that's obvious.
Although, true confessions, I Googled and made taco dip this year, which I've never done before, and uh-huh. I don't even really watch football.
So maybe that put it over the top. You're the one.
I guess so.
It would have been, you know, brat grilling or homemade cheese curds or something. No, you put it over the top. Taco dip, the official holiday food.
It was pretty good taco dip.
Okay, bring some in next time.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see.
All right, share your taco dip recipes. Message us on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.